For the first one, I said it's x, like, it takes me like x minus 5 times x minus 10 times all the way to x minus 5 r.
Same by 2.
Subtract 1. You use 4 or something.
No, yeah.
You multiply, use
subtract
1 of 4, and then you add 2.
Basically, you intermediate value theorem that mother a billion times.
Professor, you are going to present solutions, right?
But it's not so easy to prove.
He doesn't hear. Are you going to present solutions?
Yeah.
Today?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to present solutions.
No, he's going to present solutions.
Right,
so I can listen.
Everybody gets to tell about their amazing solutions.
That's fine. Or am I not so amazing?
Okay, so now,
Okay,
so here's an example. All of you are excitedly telling everybody else how you did your problem. So who wants to tell everybody how they did the first problem?
Not me. Too hard.
Okay, so
see you
to the board.
What's your name?
Steven.
Steven, thank you. That's it.
Okay, so right. So basically this is kind of the same as what was done in chapter 2 of the course notes. You just have to like replace Z with R a whole bunch of times. And so the first result is if you have M and N, which are R modules, such as M is contained in N, and N is finitely generated. Then, Then M is finitely generated. And to do that, you just say, well, 0 goes to M, goes by the inclusion map to N by projection to N minus M to 0. That's an exact sequence. And N is finitely generated over a Noetherian ring, so it's a Noetherian module, therefore M is a Noetherian module, therefore M is finitely generated, and you're done. Alright, so that's the first result, and we'll sort of put that aside for now. And then there's the result, like exact analog of what was in the book. If you have alpha in K closure, then Z adjoint alpha the ring is finitely generated.
Should be R bar, not K bar.
No, K bar.
So Z adjoint half is, if and only if.
Right. If and only if,
R.
Yeah, R. Right, if and only if A is an R bar. Alright, and so the way you prove this is basically the same that was in the book. So if A is an R bar, then you just say A to the N plus C1, A to the N minus 1, and so on is 0. Like that, let that be a monic polynomial which alpha satisfies. And then you have R adjoint alpha generated by 1, alpha, and so on up to alpha to the n minus 1, which is a finite set. Otherwise, if R adjoint alpha is finitely generated, say it has polynomial generators f1 alpha to fn alpha. Well, let's call it k just to distinguish between this and that. Then let d be greater than the maximum of the degrees of the fi for all I. Alpha to the d is in this ring, so we can write it as some linear combination. Let's call it bi fi of alpha over I equals 1 to k. But this has degree d, and this has degree less than d, so we have a monic polynomial which alpha satisfies. Therefore, alpha is an R bar. So that proves this lemma. And then you just say, take alpha and beta in R bar, then Z adjoint R adjoint alpha and beta
Z
is finitely generated, because R adjoint alpha is and R adjoint beta is, and you just take the products of all the generators of the two. So, R adjoint alpha plus beta is a subring of that, as is R adjoint alpha beta. But this is finitely generated, so these are both finitely generated. So by this result, alpha plus beta and alpha beta are in R bar. Therefore, it's a ring.
Sounds good to me. Any questions or comments?
What's that?
One.
Well, okay, so one and zero and all that are in it because R is a subring. But, yeah.
Right.
And I did note that on my exam, by the way.
Okay, and also, Arabi keeps suggesting dropping a Noetherian, so that's fine.
So
well, I use it at this step.
Yeah, use it here.
Yeah. So
the thing you can get rid of it is here. So here we show that these two things are equivalent. Alpha is an R bar, and R alpha, FG. So this is also equivalent to this. There exists, we have a fixed C above here. There exists C, a subring of, I guess, whatever big ring. In this case, it'll be of K bar, I guess, such that C is finitely generated. And R of alpha is contained in C.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason, okay, so this,
you're really using this three.
Right, so this we've done. This, you just set C equal to R alpha. For this direction, so let's take a basis for C, x1, xn, and consider the left multiplication by alpha map as a linear operator. So I'll call this T. It'll have some matrix. So let's take F to be the characteristic polynomial of the matrix. We know the characteristic polynomials are always monic. We know that f of t of x is going to be 0 for all x in our thing, in well, in C, among other things. So we also have that f of t is going to have the same action as f of alpha. So in particular, we can set x equal to 1.
Could have asked a slightly more difficult problem. Great. Excellent. Excellent. Okay, so what about the next problem? Oh, okay. Sign of the indiscriminate of the number two in terms of the signature.
This one is P. So
does that mean you got a 10 out of 100 on the midterm?
Probably.
So,
I kind of got the first problem. And the fourth, and probably some of the third. So, what was the problem again?
There's a problem with the solution in the name, just in case. Just
kidding. Oh, it does have the solution in the name. No, I want my solution. There's a.
Okay, it's over here somewhere.
Okay.
Oh, mono.
No, it's too many pages here. Okay, so we want to prove that if OK is a ring of integers in a number field, and K has 2s cup x embeddings, K has 2s cup x embeddings. So we want to show, we want to find the sign of the discriminant. So the discriminant, okay, is determinant of the basis and the conjugates of the basis. I could use better notation. Square. I could use better notations, but I'm not going to. So, let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that a matrix has two rows, x and y, okay? The matrix has other rows, but two of them are x and y. And we're going to denote it using this very bad notation. Yeah, this means that the matrix has these two rows, x and y, but we don't care about the other rows of the matrix. And I'm going to take its determinant.
Did you write up your solution like this?
Yeah.
It's a good thing you're presenting it, so I'll wait.
Well, no, I explained what I mean.
Okay.
So this equals the determinant. I'm going to do this so you can see what I'm doing. Even though you already know the solution because it's probably easy. Equals that, which equals. This should be a Y, though, nice. So far, all I've done was all my trivial operations, and for these two rows, X and Y, and I got those. Now, suppose that X and Y are complex conjugates, then X plus Y is going to equal the real part, and X minus Y is going to equal I times the imaginary part.
Wow.
Oh, 2 times the stuff, actually. Yeah. And that, of course.
Wait, there's a minus sign and then it disappears.
Oh, did it? Let's bring it back. It's not like a minus.
It doesn't matter anyway.
Yeah, it's going to get squared away.
It's real.
Yeah.
And then let's bring it over and we're going to have 2i times. Oh, a determinant here, a little determinant. of React's Mx. Consider then that thing over there. So if for every conjugate pair we do what we just did over here, we can bring out a 2i for each conjugate pair, and all of the other rows of the matrix, and all of the rows of the matrix will be real. Because you have all the real embeddings, and then for each of the complex embeddings, we've taken the real part and the imaginary part, which are both real, and we've taken out an I. And there are S of these, so we take out I to the S times some real number.
2S. 2S.
Right?
No,
two is a real number.
Oh, my gosh.
Because we're talking about...
Alright, then you're squaring.
And then we square it, we get... This becomes I to the 2s.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, I squared equals minus 1. So this gets minus 1 to the s. And we go to this. And that's called a hash bro.
Really?
Really.
Mauro, you're the best math storyteller.
There's
also
a solution to this?
Yeah.
Sure.
There's also actually an uglier solution to this.
Well, I don't think this is uglier. Actually, I
really want you to use chalk.
But this one's really good.
I'll just point at this.
Okay.
So let's call this matrix A that we're squaring. And you can look at A, or I'll use chalk. So
Hermitian conjugate?
That's a really bad arrow.
So you have A, and then you look at the complex conjugate of A, and these. And because the complex embeddings come in pairs, you know that the difference between this and this is S row swaps. So each row swap brings a factor of minus 1. So you have the determinant of A equals minus 1 to the S times the determinant of A conjugate. And then when you multiply by the determinant of A again, you get... Well, let's not do that yet. Let's just, okay, the fact that you have this means, well.
Just multiply both sides by det A.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you multiply both sides by det A, and then it's all good. You have that this is either like purely real or purely imaginary. And the
or,
so
or if S is positive, then you have determinant of A conjugate
yeah.
equals determinant of A, in which case it's real.
Right.
Bar.
Well, the determinant of A bar is
well,
the conjugate of A.
Yeah,
determinant
of
A.
Of A yeah.
It like factor, like. It can be used with determinant.
But if
you
yeah. can extend
it.
Yeah, make the line
yeah.
longer.
Make the line longer.
Make the line
longer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
solve
yeah.
yeah.
It made sense when I wrote it because at that point I haven't yet slept.
Good one.
Unfortunately, I've slept, so when I read this.
Lucky you.
Okay, so it's 2. Now, 3a. Does anyone want to talk about 3a?
Yeah.
B and C? I mean, what's it B? Okay.
B, you mean
no, A first.
A.
I can show
A.
E.
No.
S.
Okay. Does everybody's solution to 3a boring and easy?
Is it just
or wrong?
Okay. What did you say?
Or wrong.
Or wrong, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait,
checking
okay,
homomorphism, my worst enemy.
I used 3C for 3B though.
I used my solution for 3C
okay.
for 3B.
Yeah,
yeah.
I
was going to, but I ran out of time.
Also.
I just did 3B,
but
I couldn't do 3C.
I used the
magma
muscle.
3C for 3B. Okay, so who wants to tell us about 3C?
I did without 3C.
What?
I did without 3C.
Okay.
I did 3B without
3C. Okay, well, show us how you did 3B without 3C.
Yeah, I can do that.
Oh,
well, actually, can I erase this? Yeah, you can erase it. You can talk about your solution.
Yeah, I actually had this example before the exam. I mean, was.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you start with this field. Which you call K, and then so you look at the ideal generated by Q and 1 plus minus 5. Yeah. Well, this is an ideal, and then you look at the extension of K this is the this is called Hilbert class field extension of this, right?
I mean, not called, but by definition, whatever. So it's
yeah.
Hilbert class field.
Hmm?
Is that the Hilbert class field?
Yeah,
like
Hilbert.
Yeah, it is. Okay. It's the map.
The,
by the way, the Hilbert class field in the field is the maximal unramified abelian extension of the field.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So when we begin ideal, so we look at this ideal of J. We call this J. This is an ideal of OL, and its principle. So my claim is that J intersects OK equals 2 comma So our claim is that we have a principal ideal here, and then when we intersect with OK, you got something non-principal. Yeah. And you do this by, well, first of all, this is a factor of 2. When you factor 2 by Kammer's method, which is you factor x squared plus 5 mod 2, which is x plus 1 squared mod 2. Therefore, 2 equals 2 comma 1 plus minus 5 squared. Therefore, this is a prime ideal, right? And then, well, now you just need to check that 2 lies in this ideal, which is to say that 2 plus 1 over I is in OL, which is obvious, right? So this is to show that 2 is in I. But this proves that 2 is in I.
I mean J.
And then you want to prove that this one is in I. Is in J, sorry. And then over I. That's just some computation. It's I guess it's 1 plus root 5 over 2 plus I times 1 minus 5 over 2. Hence, these are both integers, algebraic integers of L. This is an OL. Therefore, this guy is in J. And thus, these both are in J. And we also know that J can't be the whole ring, right? I got the things first here. J can't be the whole ring.
I had it right.
No.
Yeah. J is an OL ideal, so I think you had it right.
Oh, yeah.
No, J and I.
Okay, so I have... So I have, well, I cannot be equal to OK because this one does not contain 1, right? So I have this. And I know that it contains the prime ideal, which is I. Yeah. This is my claim, so I'm going to erase this. It contains I. And I know that this is a maximal ideal because O sub k is the Dedekind domain. Therefore, this must be equal. The only thing that needs to be checked is that this is not a principal ideal. This is not hard to check.
This is a norm. Great. Excellent. Okay.
Your notes actually give an example of this. You can do this with 3, 2 plus rad 10,
uh-huh.
And then you adjoin like rad 2 or something.
And then you see that it becomes principal.
Also, you can k could. L could be K adjoined the square root of 2 instead of the square root of 9.
Mm-hmm.
Works just as well.
Now, what about people who use their solution to 3C? Does anyone want to discuss that, Karina?
You want to see 3C or?
Sure. But when you do 3C, mention the application to 3C.
We know that CK is finite. This means that there are some, it has n classes, I1, I, n, I, h. M was my other thing. And then it's also because it's finite, each of these has to have a finite order, so there is this sum nj such that it's equal to, well, the class of 1, which means that there exists some aj in k such that ij mj equals, or that is aj times ok. And okay, so now if we take ij to mj times ol, this is going to be also aj, and this is going to be right. So the point is that I want to take L such that I want to take L to be K adjoint with the nth roots of all the AJs. So and then this in OL is going to be well, let's say this is alpha J to the mj. And this we can rewrite as ij times ol to the m is j. And since we know that ol is, since we know that, the div ol is torsion free because we proved on the homework, this means that ij times ol is equal to the ideal lj, alpha j. And the alpha j are in L, of course, because I just. And that's it. And for 3B, I didn't use the whole construction, so I just took some prime ideal I just took some prime ideal P in CL, and then I did the same thing, but we had that P kind of the sum power M is just A, and I just added the absolute of A.
Okay.
To
Sorry.
And then did the same thing. So
but
P.
Your P is really in CK.
Is in CK, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. And then I took the compression, and then this became principal in this. And
right.
Then I just took
right.
The map, what it was.
And then you checked the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That map, if it were a homomorphism.
Okay.
Yeah, if it were a homomorphism, it should have taken 1 to 1. And
right.
It takes P times OL to P.
Right.
Which is not by choice, I chose P.
Yep. I hear this is tricky because you're using two things. You're using finite instead of class group and the fact that the fractional ideals are free of the
yeah.
M group. So you have to kind of combine two things that we did. Okay, any comments or questions or alternative strategies? Or
I have a question.
Sure.
So I didn't really use it for this part, but like in defining the node I kind of wanted to use, the fact that you know, if you have a prime or base of any ideal, but specifically a prime ideal
yep.
in OK, then
mm-hmm.
POL is going to not be the whole ideal.
POL is not the is not equal to OL.
Yeah, as in there exists a prime above it. Basically.
Right, right.
Like, how do you prove that without doing something?
Yes,
it's
turning a class in community development.
Yeah, like not, I think
yeah.
I do it like localizing and using Nakayama's law or something. But that's like
that's basically
not
how you do it.
Yeah,
sure.
That's basically how
okay.
you do it. I think there's something like that.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it is a really technical name too. I think it's called like the going up lemma.
Yeah.
For here, you can do it with taking the norm and trying to get beta is not the unit, this output is not the unit.
Yeah, yeah, I did that, but here it works fine anyway.
Yes, but
then yeah. And then the note, you can use the note like, find the note, you can go if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Right, so almost done. So the last problem is the totally real and totally complex one.
Okay. I got this at 3:30 this morning.
So I don't know if it's a solution, but it's continuous term.
Wait, it's what?
Was it a solution?
I got this at 4:30 this morning.
Wait, and how did you describe it? Was the adjective?
Well, it's my solution, if not correct, is continuous to a correct solution.
Okay, so
you take this mofo.
Wait, what do you need to show?
Oh, you need to show, you just need to show there is some, like, polynomial in Z that's irreducible of degree N,
so
and it only has real roots.
Okay, so your claim is that every single integer, every positive integer occurs as the degree of a totally real field. Okay.
So you take x minus 2 and you subtract 1. And then what's going to happen is this. So you know that this, suppose that there is a non-trivial factor. So you have f and g, and by Gauss's lemma, you know that they're in z instead of just q. Like, they're in z of x instead of just q of x. So fg plus 1 has n roots. Now, what does this mean? This means at those n roots, which are 2, 4, through 2n, f and g are either negative 1, 1, or 1, negative 1. This means f plus g has n roots at those points. And since, and now you need to make two assumptions. First, I'm going to assume that n is greater than 2. Because n is 2 is sort of easy, because you just take like square root of d or something, and n is 1 is trivial. So suppose this is greater than 2. In that case, what's going to happen is you can't have a monic factor, because if you had a monic factor, right, then this thing has a root, like at an integer. And you can check all the integers, and it's obviously not true, because...
Could you have a monic root, but it would have, a monic factor would give you a root that's an algebraic integer, but not a rational integer?
But forget what I said about the monic thing, you don't need that, I think. Anyway, no, just look at f plus g. This has n roots, right?
Yeah.
But f plus
n,
g.
Wait, what is that n
roots? These n roots.
But, so f has...
Because f and g are either minus 1, 1, or 1, minus 1 at...
I'm totally confused.
No. So at each of the points 2 to the 2n,
right.
Yeah.
fg is negative 1. Therefore, f and g have to be negative 1 and 1 in some order.
Because they're both in z.
Their values are...
Yes.
The values at those points.
Yeah, the values at those points are 1 or minus 1.
Okay.
But f and g are polynomials of some degree that is less than or equal to n. So the sum of their 2 degrees is n, right?
Well, right.
Well, it's less than n if it factors.
Less than n if it factors. Strictly less.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So this way, this cannot, so this cannot happen unless like f equals g, is, unless f equals negative g, unless f equals negative g. But then what's going to happen is you're going to have like f squared plus 1 is this thing. And you can take, and you can take some, you can obviously show that this thing takes negative values while this doesn't. So now it suffices to show that this thing actually has n real roots. And to do this, you evaluate it at 1, 3, 5, etc. So at 1, you get a huge factorial. This is again assuming n is greater than or equal to 2. Well, for 1, it doesn't. And then at 3, you also get like a huge factorial. Like, it's a double factorial. So it's like factorial besides the middle terms, besides the even terms. So it's like 1 times 3, etc. So at 3, this thing is going to be greater than 1 unless n is like 2. Right? Because you can multiply 2 ones and then odd numbers on each side. But we already exclude the case n equals 2. So any of these points is going to be some really big number in modulo. But it skips signs each time, because, you know, obviously it goes from minus to plus, and it switches signs at all the points. So by intermediate value theorem, there exists a zero at n places when you're done.
It's slightly easier if you just multiply every constant in that by 2, and then it's irreducible by Eisenstein.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sure. Alright. Yeah, that's true, because then everything has a 2 and this
is different. Is it already irreducible by Eisenstein when you multiply by 2?
Well, if you switch the minus 1 to a minus 2, then it's irreducible.
Yeah.
Or plus 2,
I guess.
I don't know, I mean...
Well, then you need to handle
then you can't
two
do this
separately.
I sort of like the fact that you can actually say something about f plus g, so just fg. Because this uses the fact this is 1 and not some other number, like
right.
2.
It's a good Olympiad solution.
Any comments? There are any questions? Other solutions?
Other solution.
Okay, what's yours?
A and B actually.
Sure,
so the only thing it uses is you use Dirichlet's theorem on primes and arithmetic progression a tiny bit. And it's cute after that.
I was trying to do that too, actually.
Okay, so let's. So
and I'm like, no.
You can erase some of those things.
Not, I don't think I even do really.
It's 5 in the morning, Dirichlet's theorem does not exist.
We're gonna try
no, it exists, but I don't know how to prove it.
So let's take p congruent to 1 mod k. Let's start with this field. Q adjoin P3 with unity. From the yeah, sure. So this has Galois groups cyclic of order P minus 1.
Mm-hmm.
So take a generator. Well, okay, so the idea is we have a cyclic group, so there's just an element of order P minus 1. So there's going to exist an element of order P minus 1 over K because you take the generator. Yeah. So there's just a subgroup H of order of P minus 1 over K.
Mm-hmm.
So then take L to be the fixed field of H under K.
Mm-hmm.
This thing. Sorry. So actually, one more thing. I want this here. Okay?
So
we can do that. So.
Yeah,
so wait, let me think. Am I doing totally real or totally complex right now? So
totally complex.
The three and the two might be.
These all the roots are,
I mean,
the roots
so
are real.
So for one of them, I mean, the thing is, for one of them, I want this thing to be even. For the other one, I want them to be odd. And I take k in one of the
oh,
here,
must be
one
totally
and k
complex.
Plus one another. So yeah,
you're
going to
take the fixed
field.
Totally
right. So, yeah. Well, so that's the idea. So if this thing is even, then the conjugation map is contained in it, because that's the only element of order two.
Oh, this is totally
real. And so it's totally real. If this is odd, then it's not, and so this is totally complex. Because for normal things, you know, if it's not fixed under conjugation, then it's totally
complex.
Yeah.
Once you have a square root of minus one in your field, that field is totally complex. Because there's no way to embed square root of minus one into the reals.
So wait, let me just work out which case I was doing. Or I'm checking notes. But okay, so I mean, if we want P minus 1 over 2k to be even, so which case should be easier?
Well, complex conjugation, totally real is the case when you have complex conjugation in H. So I guess.
So totally.
Since you've divided by 2, you mess things up for having.
I'm trying to figure out which case I'm trying to. Oh, actually, no. Yeah, so that's exactly probably what I want. Oh, sure. That's what I wanted to do. So this is the case. So P minus 1 over K is going to be divisible by 2. So we're going to have complex conjugation in here.
Right.
So this is going to be totally real.
That's right.
So a totally complex case, we note that, well, so K is even. So K minus 1 is odd. So we note that 1, that this is this, is equal to k plus 1 comma 2k. So we can find p congruent to k plus 1 mod 2k. This is for the case where k is even for the totally complex case. Then, so you know, p minus 1 equals, p minus 1 over k, that's what I want. P minus 1 equals k plus 2km equals, yeah. Odd. So, now we're going to be able to construct a subgroup that does not contain complex conjugation. So the field's going to be totally complex.
Okay, did anybody figure out how to do this without using Dirichlet's theorem?
You could do it with just the Euclid's thing on.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I mean, you can do like the Euclid trick on, like, the same thing with infinite primes, but you can do it with any 1 mod 2k.
Okay.
Right? Because you just take, you say, okay, suppose there's.
But there's still the k plus 1 part to worry about.
Yeah.
But of course, you could. Actually, after you've done the first part of the. Wait. After you've done the totally real part of the problem, just take your answer,
whatever
the field is, and join I, and you get the totally complex part.
Or you can get that with the Chinese remainder theorem and what you have to
write. You can do.
Yeah, I couldn't write this up, but like, I saw it. It's like, oh, this is pretty cute.
Or you can just
then
multiply
I came
a bunch of quadratic polynomials together and add one. Or add two.
Or
add
use
one.
Like x to the 2s plus 17 or something.
Okay.
No, x to the 2n plus any p works, if you just want the complex thing.
I just did x squared minus 10. Or, I'm sorry, x squared plus 10 times x squared plus 100 times blah, 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 plus 2. And I used Einstein. And I got that... The degree can be 2 times integer.
For complex.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I want to thank whoever who asked the office hours question.
Sure,
what field has degree 0?
The trivial field?
What's the
Okay. Like,
the
Z?
Zero ring.
The zero field?
Yeah. It has a
field with
there's
a positive characteristic.
I think there's a 1 in there, isn't there? Isn't 1 common 0 field?
No, that's
but
a ring.
Well, that's F2.
Well,
it has like
okay, fine.
Or
the finite
zero.
Zero.
It's an extension of the rational.
It's not
yeah.
Is
it
kind of
equal
to 1?
You get the zero.
It has really kind of an extension of
the rational.
It's not like a contraction of the rational.
How do you current check? Okay.
You
fine.
One
yeah, yeah,
zero.
Yeah, sure, sure.
That's really
it.
For A, I have a little. There's something similar, but a little different idea.
Well, sure.
As for the immutable. So. Reduce it to the van der Waals determinant.
No,
hey, I did that on 2. It's so convoluted, but it works.
Is it totally positive?
Oh,
I want to prove that today.
Equals t to gain plus 2xn minus 1 t to gain minus 1 plus 2x1t minus 2. Automatically reducible. And then if we guarantee that x0 is negative, at 1 is positive, and so on. It depends on whether n is even or not. So we end up with n minus 1 conditions. Like, for example, at 0 less than 0, and at 1 greater than 0, and so on. And each of these conditions looks like a linear combination of these, of the x's, either greater than some number or less than some number. But when we write down the determinant, it happens to be the van der Waals determinant, if we use, for example, the integers. So we know that if we pick here some rational number less than 0, so the condition will be like bn minus 1, b to the n minus 1 x n minus 1, bx less than q, for example. We can find x1 and xn rational such that this is less than q, without loss of generality q less than 0, then multiply by the common denominator and get integers. More complicated.
And just writing down the answer.
Well, if you multiply by the common denominator, doesn't the constant term no longer, isn't it no longer 2? Or
no, you end up with a rational solution. So this
oh, I see, and then you make the, you make
then
the
you
xy rational.
And then you can q and q
then
equal to
q.
Right. Yeah, sorry. What do you do after you draw the van der Waals matrix? What did you do?
Then
you drew that equation, and I didn't know what you did.
After you write the van der Waals determinant,
right.
You find the solution. You pick some rational number q. Whenever your condition is less than 0, you pick a rational number q less than the number you want this to be less of, to be less. You know, you want b to the n minus 1, xn minus 1, plus b1x, less than some constant. So without loss of generality, c is less than 0, and you pick rational q less than c. And you solve when it's equal to q.
Another question then. It looks like you have a system of, like, it looks like you want n plus 1 constraints because you want them on either side of n roots. But you
no,
only
but
have
then
n
I can use that this goes to infinity at the end. When you calculate, you need n minus 1 conditions.
Well,
for example.
So that takes care of the n, what about at the beginning?
What?
Like what about before the first root?
Well,
it
also goes to infinity.
Well, the n is
but in which direction? Oh, I see, okay.
Depending on whether n
the sign switch
okay.
Is always
okay.
Going the right direction.
Okay.
So if you have -1 to the n sign change. So,
yeah.
You'll go the right way.
any further comments?
I think in my solution I explicitly solved Kalyan's
integration.
Wasn't that bad?
You explicitly solved what?
Oh, not quite. Instead of 0, 1, 2, 3, I had different, larger, spread out constants, but then I explicitly wrote down the polynomial.
Okay.
Freedom,
what did you do?
I have a solution, but it's an analytic. Well, this also is analytic, but it's a very.
Is it pleasant or unpleasant?
Well, it's intuitive, but I came up with it after.
Can you show us?
It's probably
complicated.
I'm ashamed of not coming up with that one, but can I erase that?
It would be better to erase anything else. Seems like a contrast or
something. Oh, no, it's...
Contrast.
Okay. I will probably not need all four.
Jesus.
Pretty scary.
Yeah. So... The way I did was to start with just some polynomial with real coefficients and real roots, and then show that that polynomial, and then, okay, so, like, for instance, if you take p of x to be x minus root p1, x minus pn, where p1 and pn are distinct primes, and then, well, since the reals are the closure of you know, the rationals and stuff. You can
completion.
The completion, right? You can if you write this as some x to the n plus alpha n minus one x to the n minus one plus.
Okay.
All of these are real, right? Are irrational. They're just sums of radicals, right? I can take polynomials for which. I mean, I can find a sequence of numbers that converges to h alpha n minus 1, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my claim is that I can find a sequence that looks like ak over bk, and such that 2 divides ak, 2 squared does not divide ak, and 2 does not divide bk. These are integers. That's because I want to use the Eisenstein's criterion eventually. So you can find a sequence like this because, say you have, take bk to be all odd numbers, and then take alpha j times bk, say we want this to converge to alpha j, take alpha j times bk, and then basically take, round this to the nearest number that has this property, 2 divides it, but 4 does not divide it, and that would be our a. And after I take this sequence of polynomials like this, with this root, it's clear that the limit of all of these polynomials is going to be p of x. And then I take their roots, which can be complex, of course. So I take omega k up to. So some of them might be complex, some of them might be
for
real.
For a sufficiently large k, they're not going to be, they're going to be real, right?
No. Actually,
nope.
The thing is that, no, not necessarily. But the point is that I can order them. I can take them such that they're closest to the roots of p of x.
Mm-hmm.
So I name to be omega 1, the one that is closest to square root of p1, where closest, I mean, you know, in absolute value.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I have this sequence, I can extract from it a converging subsequence, and if they are going to converge, so W, you know, all the first ones are going to converge to some C1, and then all of them are going to converge to some Cn, and then if I take pk of x, and I write it as the product of x minus Wik, and then I take the limit over that converging subsequence, this will also converge to p of x, and this will converge to the product of these things. And then you can show that these things had to be the roots square root of p1. I'm not sure why I'm using square root of p1.
It's just any real roots.
Yeah, probably. But I started with this because I thought it would be easier to find the sequence explicitly than I gave up. I don't know. So you find these sequences, and then eventually if P of x has only real roots, then I claim that PK of x will also have only real roots. Because if I take, I assume
there
that one...
sufficiently large K.
Yeah, because if I take omega k, assume that omega k I is a subsequence which is of complex roots, of only complex roots. This I can make to converge to, I don't know, then their conjugates are always also going to be roots, right? And so this means that by what I proved before, this sequence of conjugates will have to converge to one of the roots of P of x. But it will converge, so it will have to converge to, so if this converges to zi, this will have zi, square root of pi. This will have to converge to square root of pi, but since conjugate, but since this is real, it's going to be the same thing.
Can all the numbers be complex, but they still converge to a real number?
And then it converges to something with double roots, because they both
yeah,
be
but
like
then but then all the roots are this are distinct.
Just getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Right, but
then you have a
double
root.
Yeah, but then you have a
double
root.
I see.
And so this that's why I explicitly chose them
sure.
to be.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I chose primes. Oh yeah, that's
and
why
how
I
do you
chose
get
primes.
The thing to be reducible.
The PKs.
Yeah.
They just have. Well, they're.
Okay. Using
Eisenstein. Yeah, because I have that.
So every single one of them is irreducible.
Yeah.
So you could have just started with 1, 2, n instead of square root of p one, square root of p.
You mean like.
Yeah, just something that's distinct.
Yeah, just any distinct real numbers.
But then these things would be.
I think you want them irrational too.
Yeah,
right?
I want them to be irrational,
but
right?
Oh,
because
approximation.
Because
then you won't be able to approximate.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That then you don't. Yeah.
I think you can simplify the argument about it having n real roots, because you just say that if if you say the piece of K converge to P, then like on any compact subset, like one containing all n roots, the piece of K get arbitrarily close, like under the supernorm to P. So if you like let D be the minimum sort of height of any relative maximum or minimum between them, then once the distance in the supernorm is less than like half that, then you have to have n real roots because like all the maxima are still above zero and all the minima are still below zero. Yeah, there's just that like once it gets arbitrarily close under the supernorm to P of x, then roots have to be real because it just keeps crossing the x axis.
Okay. Maybe
you're just saying if the graphs look the
yeah,
same.
Yeah, it's the thing with the graph.
And the graphs intersect the x-axis. And
right.
Yeah.
Same thing. But I think that one of the things seems to be, was I think you could choose the instead of root pi, they can be any real numbers that are distinct.
Yeah.
Just make sure that the
they could be integers even.
Can't they?
The rational sequence is not like
because you can approximate one by lots of rational numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe
okay.
you can't do it as well as you can approximate your rational
okay.
numbers. You can still do it.
Yeah.
One
okay.
is, you know, any number over any other number really close to that.
Okay.
For example.
Maybe, yeah, you have a point. But I don't need any. I just need them to be distinct.
You're just using
basically.
The rationals are dense scenarios.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I don't know. I was very tired.
You don't care anything about how quick things converge here. This isn't a Diophantine approximation. Okay, any other comments about any other problems?
Are you lecturing?
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
I mean, are you going to?
Have you benefited at all from discussing the problems?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I mean, I can give a gesture thing, but never mind.
I was going to lecture. I wanted to finish. We have to finish. We have to finish the proof of Dirichlet's unit theorem. And we have 26 minutes.
Mach
so
3.
There's our goal. Finish the proof of Dirichlet's unit theorem. That's it. Okay? We better do that.
Do you have any copies of the chapter?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't.
Okay.
Sorry.
Want to share, Gary? I don't know. For my
yeah, does anybody have a copy of the chapter with them? I mean, just sit next to somebody who does.
Yeah.
There you go.
Fine.
Does anyone else?
I don't want to share with Ian anymore.
Fine.
You don't have yours? Or
I have it.
Okay, good. There's got to be some sharing. Soldiers.
Everyone are friends.
Sort of. I mean, yeah, I had this to do examples, but we don't have to. Wait, so let's get
back into this. Alright, so here's what we have to prove. You have units, use of k, inside of ok, units. And we have an embedding of, well, not quite an embedding, but a map, which is embedding up to a finite kernel of uk into r to the r plus s. And the map is x goes to, so I'll tell you actually, u per unit goes to log of the opposite value of sigma 1 of u all the way up through log the opposite value of sigma r plus s of u. And the thing in the kernel is exactly where these opposite values are 1, which is exactly the roots of unity. And there are only finitely many of that of those. And I'm calling this map sigma. We also have a map from OK into R to the N, which we call, oh wait, actually I call this one phi, sorry. We call the embedding of OK into R to the N sigma. And this is just x goes to sigma 1x all the way up through sigma nx. And that's an embedding. And we were playing these two off. We proved that the image of uk in r to the r plus s is discrete. So we know that phi of uk is discrete. And we did that by simply taking a bounded set here, pulling it back, pushing things forward over here, and using the fact that sigma of ok is a lattice. So we know it's discrete. And the thing we were trying to prove was that if you let w be the r span of the image phi of uk inside of this hyperplane, well, it's equal to this hyperplane H in R to the R plus S, where the hyperplane is the set of points where x1 plus dot 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 plus xr plus 2, xr plus 1 plus dot dot plus 2, xr plus s is equal to 0. So I want to show that this is, that w is equal to that. So in order to do that, what we did was we chose an element that was not in, so we had this funny complicated trick where we know, for example, that w is contained in h. That was easy to check just by using properties of logs. And we want to prove that h is in w. But that seems kind of tricky to set up, so instead we prove that w perp is in h perp. So this is equivalent to w perp being in h perp. And to show this, you choose something that's not in h perp and show it's not in w perp. That's a secret. There's like two little tricks there. So our, we have an f. Define a function f of x is equal to z1 log absolute value of sigma 1 of x plus dot dot plus z r plus s log absolute r sigma r plus s, sorry, sigma sub r plus s x. And here z1 through z r plus s, that is an element that's not in h perp. So z equals z1 from a z r plus s. This is not in h perp. And our goal is to show it's not in w perp. And to show it's not in w perp means to show that this function isn't the zero function. So z not in w perp, if and only if f is not the zero function. And we show that using Birch-Fields lemma. Okay, so I just recalled that from memory. Did I mess up anything? Is it consistent with what you remember from last time? Okay, so the key things are the dimensions different here and this, the setup of the problem. So we need to show f is not the zero function, which means we need to find a unit u, i.e. there's a u, such that f of u is not zero. Okay, and what we did last time was we defined that a be a certain number, and we defined a set S which was contained in R to the N, and it was just a product of intervals and disks. And then we used Blitzfeld's lemma to find an A that was in I guess in OK, such that sigma of A and it's not zero. And sigma of A intersect, well, sigma of A is in S intersect sigma of OK, and it's not equal to zero. And now we're going to use this A to construct a unit like that. Except in the construction here, we had a choice of parameters C1 through C, I think, I think it was R plus S, or yeah, C R plus S. So we have these positive real numbers, C1 through CR plus S. We use those to define A, and, well, more precisely, we use those to define S. They're basically the radiuses of all the intervals and disks. So these C1 through CR plus S, we use them to define capital S. We use capital S plus Blichfeld to define A. And now we take this A, and we're going to try to use it to construct a unit. And we'll do it, but we'll find that unless certain things are satisfied about the C1 through CR plus S, we won't be able to do anything with you. But we can vary the C1 through CR plus S, so we have a lot of freedom in how we choose them. They just have to have the property that their product, more precisely, C1 through CR times CR plus 1 dot CR plus S squared has to equal A, where this A is square root of the opposite value of the discriminant times 2 over pi to the S. And you just have, you can choose any C's that satisfy that. From those you get an S. S is a product of the intervals given by these radiuses, and, or these radii. And you get an A, which is a function of C1 through CR plus S. Now let me show you how to go from A to a unit. That's where we left off last time. So here's the funny thing you do. You note that A is a, it generates a principal ideal. So this is going from A to a unit. This is a real unit. So you take the principal ideal generated by A, and a calculation we did is that the norm of this ideal is less than or equal to some number capital A. It's less than or equal to capital A. It's the bottom of page 90. So here's a really funny way to go from A to a principal ideal. Just fix a choice, B1 through BM, of representatives for each of the principal ideals of norm up to A. And do the following. So just fix these. These are fixed once and for all. We may change the C sub I's. We're not going to change A. And we're not going to change our choice of B1 through BM. They're fixed. They only depend on the choice of the field. So fix B1 through BM such that the ideal generated by B1, the ideal generated by B2, etc. These are all of the principal ideals of norm up to and including A. So there's no equivalence via the class group. That's not playing a role here at all. These are all principal ideals of norm less than or equal to capital A.
You mean principal integral ideals?
Yes. Thank you.
There are principal and,
to emphasize, integral ideals. Yes.
Speaking of corrections, you guys did an incredible job finding typos in the notes up to this point. I'm amazed. So I'm extremely thankful.
Are you still open to more?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd greatly appreciate more. Though, I think for a credit on the exam, I have to make a cutoff time, which will be right now. But you can still send me more corrections. And I'll probably do something. I think I'll do something similar towards the end of the class again, and then it'll be the whole textbook up until that point, which will be really good for you because I'm going to be writing the second half of the textbook as we go. Much more of a mess, unfortunately. Okay, so.
I have a head start, you know.
What?
I found 3 mistakes in chapter 9.
That's okay, because
you should have submitted them 2 minutes ago.
Darn.
No, that didn't count. It was up to chapter 8. Okay, so fix these B1 through BM. But I do greatly appreciate any mistakes that, or typos that you send me, no matter what, regardless of extra credit, etc.
I want to publish this book sometime, so it'll be a lot easier if I have no mistakes in the book.
So anyways, fix B1 through BM such that
These are all the principal ideals, and the ideal generated by A is one of these. And of course, as I've phrased the proof so far, you could have just chosen the first one to be the ideal generated by A. That is one of the principal ideals of norm less than or equal to capital A. But remember, we're fixing these once and for all. We're going to vary the C's, which will change the A that you choose here. And there'll be, for some of the choices, the A won't be one of these. However, because you have equality here, they're going to be equal up to a unit. So A is equal to some unit times BI. And there I've done it. I've gone in a systematic way from an A that's chosen via Blitzfeld's lemma. So it's coming from Blitzfeld. I've gone from an A to a U. Yes?
Where are there finitely many of these?
There are finitely many ideals up to a given norm, period.
Principal
or not.
Ideals?
Any. Just if you take all ideals up to a given norm, that's a finite set. And that's something we proved. The reason is because if you have an ideal of norm less than or equal to A, then it can't have too big of index as an abelian subgroup of OK. And it, for example, this index is bounded by capital A. And then the subgroups of OK with that bounded index are contained in the subgroups of the finite group OK mod MOK, or OK mod AOK in this case. That's why it's fine. I'm not at all using finiteness of the class group or even class groups at all. Class groups have nothing to do with this. Okay, so you fix these, you get a unit. So now we need to check to see whether or not our unit works. So basically we want to compute f of u and see if it's non-zero. But we're going to have to do a little trickery to get this to really work. So let's see, what do we do? So here, this is just totally yet another cool trick. So let t be the following function of c1 through cr plus s. Noting again that A depends on the choice of C1 through CR plus S, and hence this T will also, and the U will also depend on this choice. So this U also is a function of C1 through CR plus S. So T is just the following Z1 log C1 plus dot 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 plus ZR plus S log CR plus S. These CIs are all positive real numbers. That makes sense. And here's the trick. You take the absolute value of f of u minus t, and we're going to make a choice such that first, well, we'll know that this difference is small, and second, we'll make sure that t is big. And that will mean that f of u has to be non-zero. If you can simultaneously make this difference small and t big, then f of u has to be non-zero. We'll make t big because, look, we have this linear combination of logs. And we already proved a lemma which said when you have a linear combination like this, the zi's are not all the same, then you can make it big. I mean, we proved that there exists a choice of c's with some property that makes something like this big. That's what the lemma was for. So we'll be able to make t big. On the other hand, just from the definitions, we'll see that this is small. Combining those two things, we'll be able to prove that f of u is non-zero, and that will give us the proof that the image is the whole thing, because then you have that z is not in W perp, hence you prove this inclusion, and that's what we need. Yes?
So the set S is dependent on the choice of CIs.
That's right.
Therefore,
yep.
Little a is dependent on the choice
that's
of CIs.
That's definitely the case.
Therefore, U is dependent on the choice of CIs.
I need a color chalk. Everything is dependent on the CIs I'll circle, and I'm perfectly happy with the U being. The S is dependent on the C. Almost everything is, but the B's are not. Notice I'm not going to circle the B's. I want to show there exists a U such that this is non-zero. So my strategy is to show that this is small. The difference in absolute value is small, no matter how you choose the CIs. And there's some choice of the CI so that the T is huge. Much bigger than the difference. Hence, there must be some choice of CI so that this is non-zero. That's all I need. I mean, there will be a lot of U's so that f of u is zero, but I just need that there's one where it's not zero. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first, we'll do the, so on page 91, there's this big displayed equation near the bottom, and what that is about is determining
how small f of u minus t is. And it's just a calculation. It's going to use the bound that I deduced last time. Last time, just using the property that a lies in this, or that sigma of a lies in the set S, I deduced that ci over the absolute value sigma I of a is greater than or equal to a, and ci over the absolute value of sigma I a quantity squared is greater than or equal to a. And the first is, of course, for I from 1 up to r, and the second is for I equals r plus 1 up through s. So we deduced these inequalities last time. And all they used was the fact that a lies in the set, or sigma of a lies in the set s, and the definition of s, and the definition of a. So we're going to use this now. So here's what we have, f of u minus t in absolute value. Well, first, write f of u as, well, u is a divided by bi, and f involves these logarithms. Logarithms turn multiplication into addition, or division into subtraction. So this is f of a minus f of bi minus t. Okay? And now, write this using the triangle inequality as less than or equal to f of bi plus absolute f of a minus t. And now, well, you just have to look at each one carefully. I'm going to leave the f of bi in until the end. The goal is to show that the thing on the right-hand side doesn't depend on the choices of the CIs. I don't want to have to circle it with orange chalk. That's my goal. It looks like this. See, this depends on the choices of the CIs, but I really don't want to have to circle the other side. Notice that f of bi, that doesn't depend on any choices. F doesn't depend on it. Well, I mean, there's a choice we chose the z, but after that, we don't make any choices in defining f. And bi, we fixed once and for all the generators for these principal ideals. So already we're good here. This doesn't depend. So now we have to look at the other factor, f of a minus t. And remember, there's some constraint on a. It has the property that sigma of a lies in this bounded set where it's a product of intervals. We'll just use that to show that this doesn't depend on the specific choice of CIs either. Okay, well, this does, but there's something that's a bound on it that doesn't. Okay? Makes sense. So here's how it works. You have to use this stuff up there. It's a lot to write on the board, but we can manage. So I'm just going to focus on f of a minus t, and I'm going to use the inequalities that I wrote at the top of the board to try to deal with this. So t minus f of a in absolute value, that's just equal to, just using the definition of t, that's z1 log c1 minus log absolute value of sigma 1 of a plus dot 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 plus zr plus s log cr plus s minus log absolute value sigma plus s of a. Okay, so all I've done is plugged in the definition of t, that's the first half of each term, and the definition of f of a, that's the second half of each term, since f is just defined to be this. So I'm substituting a in for x here. Okay, and now the next step is to just use the property of logs, rewrite this as c1 divided by absolute sigma 1 of a, etc. And then use this business over here. We have the things appearing in that sum. After using properties of logarithms, they're of the form ci over absolute sigma I of a. Or for the ones going from r plus 1 to s, use a little trick to write them like this, where you take a square in the log and divide by a half. More precisely, write it as absolute z1 log of c1 over sigma 1 of a plus dot dot dot. And now for the other ones, ZR plus S over 2 log of CR plus S over sigma R plus S of A, an absolute value, the quantity, whole thing squared. Okay, so I've just used properties of logarithms in going from here to here, but now it's great because these are bounded. They're all...
That's where the inequalities stop.
What have I done?
You reversed the inequalities.
Do it greater than or equal to this minus f of bi, and then we're fine.
This minus f of bi.
The absolute value of sigma I of a should be less or equal to.
Well,
no,
in the notes,
correct.
I had a typo, but then I fixed it to be bigger because that's what I thought we proved. But that seems problematic because it's not giving the correct result.
Well,
that's really puzzling.
Where did your t go?
What if you write absolute value of t minus f of a instead?
Yeah, this is not this.
That's what he
working.
Did,
so
right?
If I to write, wait, what? Write absolute value of f of a minus t.
Sure.
Yeah, you could do that, and then all these are changed to, and then you get the opposite. That seems right, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what I'm doing. I'm changing from my diverting
that's weird.
Notes. So first, emphasis, equation 914 was incorrect in the notes, and I changed the inequality to be correct, because that's what we proved in class. It's really what I wrote up there. That's definitely what you get. So now let's just switch this to f of a minus t. And that changes the signs each point to minus and plus. That puts the, that reverses this. That inverse to the minus 2. And you have the, well that's no good, that's 1 over a. But maybe that's.
But it reverses the inequality sign.
But it reverses the inequality sign. That might be fine for what we need actually. 1 over a is less than or equal to sigma I over ci.
The sign needs to go the other way. Well, then when you take the log of that, you'll get sort of a negative.
It should be 1 over a greater than or equal to that.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I shouldn't change this. Okay, 1 over a is greater than or equal to that. Okay, so now this is less than or equal to z1, and then I have a 1 over a here.
Log.
Oh yeah, log of 1 over a. What matters is it's a constant. It doesn't depend on the choice of the CIs. Plus dot 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 plus zr plus s over 2 log of, it's still 1 over a.
What if there are two negative? What if you're saying something like the minus 5 is less than or equal to minus 2? So
all the numbers we're considering are positive.
Including
well,
log
1 over a.
Log
1
over
a.
Oh, log 1 over a is negative.
It's greater than 1.
I mean, I don't think
but
it just
but
switches
but
signs
just
to the beginning and make it work.
What? You don't think it work?
I mean,
never
what's
mind.
Wrong with the derivation of the original? You kind of should
the inequality is in the wrong direction.
Yeah, yeah. Wait, where do they flip?
If it's less, you get a contradiction, so it has to be greater. If ever you have a less than the... Okay, so... What I prove in the notes actually is sigma. Okay, actually the derivation is correct as it was. There's an additional flip. So let's just go back to the argument as we had it before, and everything looks fine. Okay, so these inequalities are the other way around. I was just totally confused. Which is really good because otherwise it's not going to work. Okay. The argument in the notes is correct, and it gives the inequality in the notes that you have. And it's not a typo. So here you actually have log of a. Log of a, and then we're almost done. This sum, call it b, this sum does not depend on the choice of the CIs. So I do not have to circle it in orange. This sum doesn't depend on the choice of CIs. Also, by the lemma I proved, you can make the t,
you have to check a little the hypotheses, but they work fine. You can make the t as large as you want, subject to the constraint that the product of the CIs is equal to a.
And you just make the you make the t so it's bigger than b in absolute value. And what you have is you have f of u minus t is less than or equal to b, but t is greater than b in absolute value. Therefore, f of u has to be non-zero. So okay, that's that difference in t. Then because.
Well, that thing plus f of bi, right? Like b plus f of bi absolute value.
Plus f of
bi. Yeah, you drop that.
Like
yeah.
You add you
b-
like replace b by b plus f of bi absolute value. Where.
Oh yeah. Because okay. define b to be f of bi plus this quantity. Yeah, you're right. It could depend on which I you choose, and that depends on the C sub R's. So, the C sub I's. So, good point. Max the F of bi plus this upper bound.
And you want upper bound of the F of bi?
Sure. Might as well. Okay, now you have that the difference f of u minus t, you can make it, well, first, it's definitely less than this capital B. Second, by the lemma, you can make t as big as you want. Therefore, f of u is non-zero for some choice of c1 through cr plus s. Therefore, amazingly enough, therefore, t is also not in w perp. Therefore, h is contained in w perp. So we've proven that the image of the log map on units has its R span equal to the whole hyperplane. So we've proven, amazingly enough, that there are lots of units. So Pell's equation, for example, has solutions. Yes?
Yeah.
Where did we use the fact that c is not an H perp?
Well, let's see. Well, I mean, you don't need to do anything there, I guess. So we do know that W is in H, that means that H perp is contained in W perp. So if Z were in H perp, then we'd know it's in W perp. So we'd have a zero function. So we better have used it somewhere.
But the ZIs are not all the same?
Yes, oh, that's it. H perp is exactly where the ZIs are all the same. So in verifying the hypothesis to the lemma, which allows you to make this really big, it's crucial that the ZIs not be all the same. Or really, it's actually twice the second half of the ZIs. But the condition on the ZIs is part of the input to the lemma. If you don't have that, you can have like one of the ZIs equal to 1 and the other minus 1. And then whenever you choose the Cs, you have cancellation among the ZIs. So you cannot make this big. It totally fails if you look at it carefully. Okay, so class is over because they ran out of time. So I'll see you on Tuesday next week.
There's another problem.
It's a short one.
Is it as short as the one today?
Short
cool.
In terms of the amount of time we have to do? Or
no, it's
awesome.
Pretty short.
What will we cover next week?
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to do... decomposition group and ramification, more about ramification and which of continuous elements. And then Thursday will be a substitute, which is Frank Calipari. He's going to talk about Galois representations. So do you want to meet earlier? Let me check my schedule.
Oh, yeah, earlier should also be fine. So I have
office hours from 3 to 4, and I have
I'm meeting up. So, we can meet at my, during my office hours, since no one ever comes. No one ever comes. Except sometimes on trade shows it comes.
Well, I think it's, you have to explain to him some of the things in class.
No, he's in his senior thesis with me also.
No, I know.
We can meet at 2, I think. No, you're meeting those people at 2. We can meet before the meeting at 1. Basically, it's either meeting at 4 as planned, or come to. But if nobody's at my office hours, we can meet then. Or we can meet at 1 o'clock.
Is there gas in here now?
Normally, there is, actually. Dylan has his topology class in here. Yep, he does.
Okay, come on in. When he comes, we'll go outside.
Yeah.
You know how long? 4 ages?